And members, I'll call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Elections Committee to order for March 9th, 2021. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Nash.
Present.
Representative Bonner.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Cleborne.
Present.
Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Representative Mason.
Present.
Representative New Brindley. Representative Pulowski.
Pulowski present.
Representative Klom. A quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Spreck. And members, I'm going to hand the chair over to Vice Chair Carlson. I have a bill I have to present in another committee. And so, Andrew, you can take it away, and I'll be back when I'm done presenting my bill.
Thank you, Carol Nelson. We'll see you soon. First on, okay, minutes. We need to, did we approve minutes yet? I don't think we did. No. Okay. Let's see. Representative Elkins, have you had a chance to review the minutes from yesterday?
I have, and we'll move their approval.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins moves the minutes from March 8th. All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say no. The minutes are adopted. The first bill on the agenda for today is House File 1350. Representative Bolden is the chief author of the bill. This bill is for cities of the first class, authority to provide to impose ordinances on land or fee dedications on permit applications. And we're going to move to adopt the local government division report first. And I believe we can do this by voice vote. I'm seeing heads nod. All those in favor of adoption of the local government division report, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed, say no.
No.
That is a couple dissenting. That motion is approved. Next, we have, Representative Bolden's bill to move House File 1350 to be referred to the General Register. Representative Bolden, if you would, I'll move Representative Bolden's bill, House File 1350, to the General Register. Representative Bolden, if you would like to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1350 would provide a helpful tool for Rochester and Duluth to have better equity for park funding across the entire city. It would provide parity with the special authority, the other two first-class cities, being Minneapolis and St. Paul, received in 2013 around collection of parkland dedication fees for redevelopment sites and commercial industrial. Current statute only allows cities to require parkland dedication only if the property is subdivided or at the legal division of unplatted land. Minneapolis and St. Paul received special legislation in 2013 that allows their municipalities to require parkland dedication when most development occurs. This was due to the amount of development and redevelopment of existing parcels that does not require subdivision of the property, but still generates need and impact for the park system. Rochester and Duluth are now experiencing this situation and are seeking state legislation to provide an opportunity to have a local conversation about how parkland dedication could be collected more equitably. This bill would bring more equity and consistency to park funding by equalizing the collection and use of parkland fees across a wider spectrum of properties in the community. Secondly, it aims to provide adequate parkland improvements serving the downtown area, a growing part of Rochester. We all know the importance of parks, especially in a pandemic, for mental health, community gathering, exercise, and more. I have with me a council member from Rochester, Sean Palmer, who will be providing brief testimony on the bill. We also have Mike Nigber, head of Parks and Forestry for the City of Rochester, and Heather Corcoran, legislative policy analyst for the city, with us today. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I will now turn it over to Council Member Palmer.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Bolden. If your first testifier could proceed with their testimony. And members, we do have several testifiers, both in support and opposed to the bill today. I do want to allow adequate time for member questions. So we will be going to a vote on this bill at 9:05. So if testifiers could please keep their comments succinct and brief, that would be very much appreciated. Councilmember Palmer, if you would please proceed with your testimony.
Good morning and thank you, Chair. My name is Sean Palmer. I am a councilperson for the City of Rochester. I serve the 5th Ward. Rochester City Council is a nonpartisan council. I'm here today as a long advocate for our parks and a founding member of our Parks Foundation. I also work in the building industry and have for the last 40 years. I thank you, Representative Bolden, for carrying this bill for us. This bill would provide more consistency. Right now, some developers pay it, those that that develop in subdivisions, and those that don't redevelop or in a subdivision. Simply put, this focus should be treating people equally. Downtown people deserve to have the parks and cities, the parks and the other part of the cities do. And the city is responsible for providing these parks. To give you some sense of scale that we're working with, Rochester's the third largest city with 119,000 people, 3 million visitors a year. In 2019, we collected $23,720 in parkland dedication fees. In 2018, we collected $122,000. And a new playground costs around $400,000. Our current parkland dedication rate is roughly $366 per single family dwelling or $1,500 per multifamily. In the last 3 years, we've collected in 2020, we collected $228,000 per year in parkland dedication. Rochester is a community with 119,000 residents, a regional world center for healthcare that hosts close to 3 million visitors a year. Our city has a very strong fiscal management history. We're one of the few cities in the state that has a AAA bond rating and also received a certificate for achievement for excellence in financial reporting for almost 50 years, the longest in the state of Minnesota. Our elected city council will and has continued to take on our role seriously to protect and utilize public assets and resources that we're entrusted with. I'll give you one example. Riverwalk Apartments was built. They had 152 residential units and where once three homes were stood. They did not contribute to our parkland dedication. We have done and will continue to do local engagement with our builder, developers, and others. We see that the state legislators, we see this state legislation and authority to first stop and having the opportunity to drive our further, to drive our future conversation locally. We engage with our local builders group, the Rochester Area Builders, recently on this issue. And we have spoken with many of our area developers about this idea and have shared support for the ideas of parks, a key amenity to their properties, and noted that the current inconsistency that occurs for their projects, whether they develop in a subdivision or paid fees now or redeveloped downtown as already platted land. This is a topic that's been discussed locally for over 8 years. We are asking for support for this bill and thank you to the committee for the consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Palmer. And again, testifiers, please, next on my list, I have Ms. Heather Corcoran. For the remaining testifiers, please look at your notes, and if you could make whatever edits you feel are necessary to keep your testimony to 2 minutes. We have other bills on the agenda, and just out of fairness to everybody, if we could limit our comments to 2 minutes, that would be much appreciated. Ms. Heather Corcoran, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'll just be available as well, Mike Niegber, if there are questions, and we'll let you get to the next testifiers.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, and thank you for being with us here today. Representative Bolden, did you have any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair. I don't believe I do.
Okay. Next on my list, I then have Mr. Matthew Spellman. Mr. Spellman, if you would proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Matt Spellman. I'm with the Minnesota Realtors Association. Our association represents over 21,000 real estate professionals helping buyers and sellers across Minnesota transfer all types of property. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Each year, our members develop and approve a legislative agenda, which our 2021 agenda included a statement of opposition to policies that increase the cost of housing. Consequently, I'm here this morning to share our opposition to House File 1350, as it clearly increases the cost of housing. Minnesota is experiencing an immense inventory shortage, with our last housing report showing we currently have less than 1 month's supply. Coupling the current inventory shortage with interest rates being as low as they are, the heightened demand on our existing housing stock continues to drive prices up, adversely impacting low to moderate income earners the most. Our most affordably priced homes on the market have seen a drastic jump in price, with the statewide median hitting an all-time high of $275,000. Minnesota needs to stimulate new housing development to bring balance into the market by alleviating some of the pressure on existing housing stock. And in doing so, government shouldn't continue to add to the cost of construction, which is ultimately passed on to the homeowner. That being said, House File 1350 only serves to add to the cost of housing, as this fee will inevitably be passed on to the homeowner. Policies like this are further burdening Minnesota homebuyers when they need help the most. If the legislature is serious about addressing the issues facing our housing market, it cannot continue to enact policies such as this. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Spellman, for your testimony. Next on my list of testifiers, I have Mr. Peter Coyle. If you would please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Peter Coyle. I'm a lawyer lobbyist with Larkin Hoffman. I represent Housing First Minnesota. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee this morning. My comments have been shared previously with Representative Bolden, so I presume she won't be surprised that Housing First continues to have reservations, if not opposition, to the proposed bill, and I say that respectfully. First of all, as Mr. Spellman just noted, Minnesota is experiencing a housing affordability crisis. We are an outlier in the country relative to at least the upper Midwest for the high cost of housing, especially at the starter home level, and the gap that exists between people of color and other populations. And this bill, with all due respect, will take us in the wrong direction. And for that reason, we are opposing it. I'm also noting that the city of Rochester recently passed a park referendum that adds significant new dollars into the parks budget. I went back and reviewed the committee hearing from last week, and I didn't note any discussion of the fact that that new source of funding was already being provided by taxpayers in Rochester. And it raises a concern for us as to whether or not this bill is needed at this time. And secondly, it represents a significant expansion in how park fees are collected from home buyers. Rochester still has a very large growing housing market for which the existing statute applies. And for our members, it doesn't seem that the change in statute is necessary at this time. And so for that reason, Mr. Chairman, we would respectfully oppose the bill, and we would urge members not to adopt it. I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to speak this morning, and I'm happy to stand for questions if there are any for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. Appreciate your testimony today. Thank you for being with us. Members, I do not have any other pre-registered testifiers, so we will move to member questions. Representative Kosnick, you are first on my list. If you would please proceed with your question.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. And Representative Bolden, nice to meet you. Haven't met you yet, but welcome to the legislature. I'm curious if this policy that you're proposing to match other cities of the first class, why is it significant that cities of the first class should be allowed to do this? And I know Rochester and Duluth are kind of have a metro-centric envy of Minneapolis and St. Paul, but you know, a city like Lakeville or Maple Grove or Plymouth is going to approach a pretty high population. Why are you not proposing this policy more broadly to other cities? And then, if you could have one of the testifiers, maybe the council member, talk about you know, he was on the planning for the parks. He mentioned they have a park levy that we just found out. You know, why wasn't it better planned out instead of continuing to socialize the cost of playground equipment across all the taxpayers?
All right. Representative Bolden, I think there was a question in there for you directly as the author, and then also a question for Council Member Palmer. So Representative Bolden.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. In terms of why we are asking for this and why not other areas, I would say, you know, we are asking for this in Rochester because our redevelopment and land use warrants it. We would like to have the conversation locally around how to implement and how to make this happen, and how to sort of equitably share the funding and the money for our park system. So we are now at a place where this makes sense for our city, just the same as it has in the past for Minneapolis and St. Paul. And then I think I will hand it off to my testifier, whether Councilmember Palmer or perhaps Mike Nigber would like to weigh in on that as well.
Yeah, Councilmember Palmer, any quick comments to the question?
Well, yes, our Parkland dedication, our Parkland referendum last November passed by 63%. And we had done a survey back in April of that year to see how much money we could raise for our parks. And it was at 61% at $2 million. We've underfunded the parks since about 2008, since we had the recession. Rochester at one time had 950 houses being built. The last year we had 225 houses being built. The cost for our parkland right now is about $30 per resident, which is far below the national average. We use a lot of partnerships with our park department to keep our costs low, and that's very important to the city council.
Thank you, Councilmember Palmer. And members, I'm getting quite a list here of members. Just to remind folks that we will be moving to a vote at 9:05, so we've got a little under 20 minutes. Members, please keep your questions succinct with a short follow-up if necessary. Also, remind members that this bill did go before local government. You can refer to the minutes from that meeting to where some of these questions, you may find the answers there as well. So please keep your questions to the purview before the committee. Next, Representative Nash, did you want to go next?
I will wrap it up, but I do know that there are amendments from my side of the aisle, and I was wondering when you're going to be dealing with amendments.
Representative Nash, let's see here. I'm not seeing any amendments. Chair Nelson, am I missing something here?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't believe there were any pre-filed amendments other than the one the author had a pre-filed amendment that I believe she's not offering.
Very well, I have that
incorrect. Why don't you go, Mr.
Chair?
Rudolph, why don't we ask
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative
Mr.
Nash.
Chair.
Representative Nash.
I believe Representative Quam had tried to get your attention.
Oh, Representative, I'm sorry. There was a lot of talking there. Representative Quam, quickly, you had a question?
Yes, for the chair. During local government, there was very little discussion. In fact, there was not any allowment of the amendments that were filed, and amendments were filed in this committee way before the deadline. So I guess I'm getting the impression that the chair is not going to allow minority amendments on some of these bills, which I think is not standard operating procedure.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Chair Nelson.
I was wrong. It wasn't on the agenda. I was wrong. I missed it. There were three pre-filed amendments. So I'm wrong. So I apologize for that, Representative Quam.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, give me just a second here. Okay. So this is the fun thing of working remotely, right? Representative Quam. Okay, here we go. So I see you have three amendments. Representative Quam, is that correct?
That is my understanding. Okay. And I took myself off of the questioning portion and was going to save the my time for the amendments.
Yes, and I think we want to deal with those now, Representative Quam. So I see that there are three amendments, your amendments, starting with the A9. Representative Quam, would you like to move the A9 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Quam moves the A9 amendment. Representative Quam, if you would proceed with describing your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill isn't just about the city of Rochester. And what is done usually sets up new cities coming to the city, the first class. Instead of the regional setup that Rochester has, I think it'd be most appropriate to have it centralized or located near where the development fees are taken. And so 20 blocks, I think, is more than enough to cover where you should have the fees going to. So it would restrict the fees collected to be used within a normal distance from the location.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Bolden, comments? Do I have any other? I have lots of hands up. Any questions with regards to the A9 amendment?
Mr. Chair, can I make a comment?
Yes, Representative Bolden, one second. I just want to see if there's any other member questions, and I'm going to be sure to let you get the final word on the amendment. I'm seeing none. So, Representative Bolden, to the A9 nope. amendment.
Mr. Chair, I do have my hand up when it's appropriate.
Okay, Representative Kosnick to the A9 amendment.
Thank you. And I believe Representative Quam, the amendment author, would get the final comments.
Fair enough.
It doesn't, you know, I guess I'm curious if the author is, why the author of the city would oppose the amendment to having money taken from prospective homeowners and but then spreading, putting the amenity not necessarily that close to where the project is. So Representative Quam's amendment seems quite common sense that if you're going to take money from a builder or developer, or, which is essentially from the new homeowner, to build the park, but you're not going to build it anywhere near where they may live, it doesn't make sense that homeowner should be getting taxed for this. And members, previously we talked about the important issue of affordable housing, and I just don't see how this bill even gets us there. But I think this is a great amendment, Representative Quam. If the government's going to take money from you for a stated purpose, it should be accessible to those people. And especially in this particular case, if it's a more multi-housing type building, that people in those housing developments should have the access to the parks if that's what the money's being used for. So I would support Representative Quam's amendment.
All right, thank you, Representative Kosnick. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would respectfully oppose this amendment for a couple of reasons. One, the 20 blocks is just sort of an arbitrary distance. Current state, Rochester is set up in zones or quadrants, so I would anticipate that this funding would stay within those zone or quadrants. That's what's done in other similar situations. Secondly, this amendment would sunset these abilities for Minneapolis and St. Paul at a point in the future. And the intention of this bill is not to change anything that Minneapolis or St. Paul is currently doing. So that being said, I would be open to continue conversations with Representative Quam around this concern.
Thank you, Representative Bolden. Representative Quam, final comment on the A9 amendment.
I think it's reasonable a walking distance be worked into the discussion if you're doing apartments and you have people that are using mass transit.
Thank you, Representative Quam.
Roll call, Mr. Chair.
Roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Ms. Spreck, if you would please take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
No.
Vice Chair Carlson?
No.
Representative Nash?
Yes.
Representative Bonner?
No.
Representative Drazkowski?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Greenman?
No.
Representative Cleburne?
No.
Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
No.
Representative New Brindley?
Aye.
Representative Pulaski?
Pulaski, no.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
With a vote of 5 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail.
Thank you, Ms. Greck. The motion does not prevail. The next amendment we have is the A-10 amendment. Representative Quam, would you like to move the A-10 amendment?
Chair, I would like to move the A-10 amendment. And the A-10 amendment is, we're talking park fees, and we're talking generally that's households. And in Rochester, about 40,000 people, back pre-pandemic, would come in and out just on Highway 14 that runs before Byron and Casson. And, if you're doing an industrial development, you're not adding households. And I think that the fee should be just restricted to households and families that would be utilizing this park. And the discussion about the center of Rochester being able to fund that for the visitors, part of the DMC funding is in regards to amenities for patients and visitors. And out of that money, that should cover people are visiting that don't live there. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Bolden, to the A-10 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would, again, respectfully oppose this amendment. Currently, you can't, and Rochester does not collect on a new commercial industrial space subdivision fee. So I would anticipate that would be part of the local conversation.
Thank you, Representative Bolden. Representative Quam, final comments on the A-10 amendment?
Yes. Again, this is not just Rochester in this bill, and this sets precedents for additional cities of the first class, Bloomington, et cetera, that might be joining that classification soon. And I think we need to be diligent in doing good governance and looking beyond just the current situation within a single city. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Members, we're going to move to a vote on the A-10 amendment. All those in favor of the A, so please unmute yourself, members. All those in favor, did I hear somebody?
Aye.
Oh, Representative Kosnick, you're voting. Okay, wonderful. I love that. Good. It's nice to know that people are paying attention. All those in favor of the A-10 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
The A-10 amendment does not prevail. Representative Quam, third and final amendment, the A-11. Representative Quam, if you would please describe your amendment. Would you please move your, would you like to move your amendment?
I would so move, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Quam. Please proceed with describing your amendment.
This amendment is meant to where a city, if you're going to be collecting for a plan change, ought to have a plan and execute it in a timely fashion. It also contains language so that any funds would be returned if not used within a timely fashion. And it has the mechanism of a property tax credit, which I believe has less of a tax impact than if cash was given back, and also may avoid, cities having to push cash out, I think is sometimes difficult depending on the exact timing. And so this would soften the effects to the city. And the final person, years later, it might be someone else that owns, say, a condo in a complex, and it might be difficult or tricky having the taxation of cash coming in, but a property tax credit, I think, would be less burdensome in a tax format. And And once again, I want to set up a mechanism that'll work across cities of the first class instead of having multiple flavors. And I would like a roll call. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Bolden, to the A11 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would respectfully oppose this amendment. The three-year time frame in this amendment is a bit problematic. The current parks capital improvement cycle is based on a six-year cycle, and 3 years is a bit of a short time to raise enough money to be used and plan and for have that whole process to go through. The other piece I would say is that this bill also contains a sunset of these abilities for Minneapolis and St. Paul, and again, that is not the intention of this bill. That being said, I would be open to continuing to work with Representative Quam on this concern area.
Thank you, Representative Bolden. A roll call on the A11 amendment has been requested, so there will be a roll call. Ms. Breck, if you would please take the roll.
Chair Nelson.
No.
Vice Chair Carlson.
No.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Drazkowski.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Greenman.
No.
Representative Cleburne.
No.
Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Representative Mason.
No.
Representative New Brindley.
Aye.
Representative Pulowski.
Pulowski, no.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
With a vote of 5 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted.
The amendment is not adopted. Thank you, Ms. Breck. Members, I have three members that would still like to speak to the bill itself. I'm going to cut it off at those three. I have Representative Cleburne, Representative Drazkowski, and Representative Nash. And then we will move to a vote. Representative Cleburne, if you could proceed with your question, please.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Chair, it's really more of a comment. I'd like to thank Representative Bolden for bringing this bill. Since Plymouth was mentioned in the earlier discussion, I just want to be on the record of saying Plymouth supports local control in these issues. And it is a matter of fairness and to make sure that everyone realizes that our parks and trails support the property values within our communities and holds those investments of our families whole. And so thank you very much for bringing this, and I ask for a yes vote from our committee members.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask the chair, first of all, is this bill going to the tax committee since it's a tax increase?
Representative Drazkowski, I have this bill going to the general register.
Okay. I wonder if Representative Marquardt's aware of this bill going through, this tax bill going through, Mr. Chair. Maybe someone should talk with him. But I have a question maybe for the author or the testifier from Rochester. We know that the city of Minneapolis and likely the city of St. Paul too aspire to be the highest density park cities on the planet. As a matter of fact, Minneapolis has already accomplished that. More parks per square mile, per capita, whatever the measurement is, than any city on the planet. Is that what Rochester is aspiring to be as they commit to this additional tax and related spending?
Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will just speak briefly and then hand it off to Councilmember Palmer. What we are looking to do is to provide equity in funding and offer more park space and green space for the residents of Rochester as we are a growing community. With that, I'll hand it off to Representative Palmer.
Councilmember Palmer, if you could be brief, please.
Our master plan does not call for that. We have a master plan we did 6 years ago, and that is what we're working for. The needs of that master plan are $80 to $100 million. Thank you.
Thank you, council member. Representative Drazkowski, a quick just follow-up, then I'm just going to move to Representative Rash. Yep, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, we have a city of the first class aspiring to be like the other two cities of the first class that are outlined in the bill and the discussion. We have cities in Minneapolis and St. Paul that are engaging in recreational spending for recreational endeavors. This is an an over-the-top bill that that an overtaxed city of Redding and the city of Rochester, as I talked to the residents and their frustration there. This is a tax increase. This is going to hurt the people of Rochester and hurt the community and surrounding communities of Rochester. I'm going to vote no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash, I have you last on my list to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just skip questions. I'll go straight to commentary. Members, we heard a bill not too long ago about ways to assess fees that will be collected earlier than they're actually being used, and I oppose that. House File 1350 does very much the same thing. This is going to collect money on the front end, and it may not be used for any foreseeable time. I believe the deadline is open-ended. I find that quite troubling. And I was listening to the testimony of the council member talking about how price increases do impact people's availability or ability to get into a home. And, you know, for every $1,000 increase in a price, you're effectively pricing out, I believe, 4,000 people. And I'm not sure if Mr. Spellman is still here from the realtors, but that's effectively what you're doing. So you're going to collect money on the front end, $366 per single family, $1,500 for a multifamily, in a city that already levied $2 million for parks within the last 12 months. And I just think that this is, it's very, very aggressive. And, you know, you put certain parcels of land in jeopardy of seeing a double whammy on collections of this. This is certainly something that I'm sensitive to. Everybody likes a good park, as do I. But Mr. Chair, this adds way too much cost. It adds way too much burden on the people who are going to be trying to live in whatever city. And it's very broad brush. This is elevating any city of the first class. You know, we talk about being precise here in the House. And to the author, her claim was that 20 blocks is an arbitrary number, but she hopes that the city of Rochester will not go beyond that. Well, I find that hoping is not often actually ever delivered when you enable certain things like this. Being prescriptive as to what you're trying to do in a bill is the way to go. So I would encourage all of my members and all of the members in the committee to vote no. This is far too broad brushed. And you could look at way too many years before it actually gets put into play before or after it's being collected. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Baldwin, a few closing comments before we move to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be brief. I appreciate the conversation. And just to reiterate, what we are looking to do is to create a more equitable way to invest in and support our parks in Rochester and looking to be in alignment with other cities of the first class. This one-time fee, as was said, is currently about $350 for a single family home, I believe is a solid investment in our green spaces and parks, and which are so important to our communities. So I would ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bolden. With that, Representative Bolden renews her motion to refer House File. I'm sorry, I renew my motion to refer House File 1350 to the General Register. And if the committee clerk would take the roll.
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Cleavorne.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
No.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative New Brindley. Representative New Brindley.
No.
Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski, aye.
Representative Quam?
No.
With a vote of 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
Motion prevails. Thank you, members. I am going to hand the gavel now back over to Chair Nelson to continue on with the meeting.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Vice Chair Carlson. The next bill on our agenda is House File 1803, Representative Herr, and I will move House File 1803 to be referred to the general register. Representative Herr, you want to explain your bill?
Thank you, Chair Nelson and members. The bill before you is House File 1803. This is a Minnesota Campaign Finance Board technical change bill, which includes provisions related to public officials, statement of economic interest, contributions, and disclosures, and exceptions that are provided within this technical language. I do have a testifier here today to speak to this bill and to answer any questions the committee might have. If it is okay with you, I will yield the rest of my time to Ms. Megan Engelhardt, who is the Assistant Executive Director at the Minnesota State Campaign Finance Board and Public Disclosure Board.
Looks like we're all a little tongue-tied this morning. Ms. Engelhardt, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Megan Engelhardt, and again, I'm the Assistant Executive Director for the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board, which is in St. Paul. So I did want to mention, too, that the technical changes do include a few changes for the campaign finance in addition to the economic interest statement. I won't go over them in depth, but the campaign finance program just needed to clean up a few statutory changes to make it work a little bit easier, and would change a few rules regarding state and federal committees providing to money to the state committee. We can use a website instead of asking them to give the form in a large PDF that we then have to store. So mostly it's just, I would call it kind of housekeeping technical changes. I'm more than happy to answer specific questions. I don't want to take up too much of your time if you don't have too many specific questions.
And I see Mr. Sigurdsson's here also to answer questions if needed. Members, any questions? One more time, any questions? Seeing no hands popping up. Representative Herr, if you want to wrap up and we can proceed to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know you all have a lot on your plate today. So I'm just going to say thank you to you and the committee for hearing House File 1803 and that the technical changes are needed. And I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Herr. With that, Ms. Spreck, with that, I will renew my motion to refer House File 1803 to the General Register. Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Nash. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Cleburne.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative New Brindley.
Aye.
Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski, aye.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
With a vote of 13 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Ms. Brick. The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Members, next is Representative Stevenson with us. Yet. If not, we'll go to the right mouse here. We'll go to Representative Claiborne's bill, House File 1585. Read the numbers right, Michael. Representative Claiborne, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I move that House File 1585 be referred to Education Policy. That is my motion.
Thank you, Representative Claiborne. If you want to explain your bill.
Yes, members, I'll keep my comments very short. We have testifiers who will speak to the bill, and I will yield my time to them. This bill does three basic things. It allows election judge trainees that are already permitted in statute to serve without party affiliation. It also has permissive language that allows school boards, if they so choose, they may determine that students are eligible for credit. And then it also says that the appointing authorities for election judges, whenever possible, would recruit bilingual high school students to serve as trainee election judges. And then finally, there is an appropriation, a one-time appropriation in year 2022 for for $500,000 that is to be used to recruit bilingual election judges and bilingual trainee election judges. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would ask that you please acknowledge Sia Herr as our first testifier. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Herr, and please say your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, and absolutely, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, members, good morning. For the record, my name is Sia Herr, and I am the Executive Director at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. I'm here this morning to speak in support of House Bill 1585, the bill before you. I've shared many times in prior committee hearings about the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community, and so I'll just say that given what we know about this community, our council believes that these requests within House File 1585 are important to Minnesota's overall strategy to create a more informed, effective, and responsible citizenry. The Pew Research Center reported in 2020 that Asian Americans make up the fastest growing group of eligible voters among the major racial groups in the United States. And that in fact, from 2000 to 2020, eligible Asian American voters grew by 139%. And we are the only major racial group in which naturalized citizens make up a majority of the eligible voters. As we have shared in committee hearings again, prior to this, Minnesota's Asian Pacific community is estimated to be the fastest growing racial community here in the state of Minnesota and across the United States. We are also a younger community, with nearly one in three of us who reside in the state being under the age of 18. This community, consisting of immigrants, refugees, and their descendants, is at this time majority refugee experience. With our more established communities, such as the Filipino or Japanese communities, reporting higher educational attainment and income levels, it's important to recall that the flip side of that is that our more recently arrived communities, such as the Hmong and the Karen, report significantly lower educational attainment and income. Not coincidentally, the first generation of these more recently arrived refugee communities are also, by and large, limited in English proficiency and rely on the younger generations to help them navigate their new home in the United States. These community members also experience the greatest barriers at the polling location, and so therefore they stand to benefit most directly from the school credit incentives and consequently the larger pool of trainee election judges that would possibly result from House File 1585. We believe that House File 1585 will provide mercy in action by assisting with the election process, and would leverage the talents and strengths of our young bilingual and bicultural leaders who oftentimes serve as cultural brokers between majority Minnesotan cultural and democratic practices and the budding democratic practices of their immigrant and refugee experience communities. And I'll conclude by simply saying that as Minnesota's voting populace reflects statewide demographic trends and becomes increasingly diverse, county election offices that have the ability to strategically recruit and place trainee election judges in targeted polling locations will be that much better positioned to more efficiently, effectively, and equitably provide Minnesotans with opportunities to be more substantively, civically engaged. With that said, Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time, and I'm happy to assist with answering any questions that members may have.
Thank you, Ms. Herr. I also have Betty Garcia Herrera, hope I said that right. Please identify yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that I see her on the list. If I see her on the
I don't see her either. Yes, I'm looking at my agenda and I'm looking through. I don't see her here. I also have Secretary of State Steve Simon. Represent our Secretary Simon, are you here just to answer questions or do you want to comment?
I wanted to comment if there's time, Mr. Chair.
There's time, Mr. Secretary. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. I want to thank Representative Cleburne and others for their work on this bill. I think it's a great idea. Many of you know that for the third time in a row, Minnesota was number one in the country in voter turnout. That's a great success for all of us and for our state. And sometimes, for all the obvious reasons, we focus on the voters. It's a victory for voters and their desire to be heard, but it's also a victory for aspects of the system. And one aspect of the system that doesn't get a lot of attention is our election judge process. It takes 30,000 people, 30,000 people to run an election in this state. That's a virtual army of people who have to go out and do this job, and they do so willingly and well year after year after year. And it's important particularly that we get young people to be engaged and motivated and civically involved. And that's why we have election judge trainees in statute to begin with. Young people as young as 16 years old by statute under current law can already participate and do most of the functions that other election judges do. So that's why we have that in there. And this last cycle was really a test case for a lot of obvious reasons. Because of the pandemic, there were we faced potential challenges in getting those 30,000 people. In the end, because of a lot of work by a lot of people at a lot of levels of government, we had no shortages. We had the 30,000 that we needed. But it really underscored some of the soft sides of the system where we could do better. And this is exactly one of those areas. I'm really particularly heartened by the fact that this focuses on high school students. Just anecdotally, when you talk to townships and counties and cities who are recruiting, training and paying election judges, they'll actually tell you that although they've already thought of the idea of trying to engage more young people in the process, they have actually pointed out, at least anecdotally, that the high school students are more reliable than the college students. Sometimes, again, this is just episodes related to me over the years, you know, a college student will blow it off or they won't show up. Not so with high school students. So the fact that this bill seems to recognize that and incentivizes that, getting good habits started early, I think is a really, really good thing. So it's an excellent opportunity as well. And I just want to say as well how gratified I am about this bill's recognition about the need for bilingual folks in the polling place, election judges and others who can help people whose native language is not English. And sometimes I and others, I think, get the question, and it's a natural, normal one. I don't blame anyone for asking. Someone might ask a question like this, and perhaps Ms. Herr has gotten this question. I know I have. People will say, hey, explain something to me. You know, you can only vote if you're a U.S. citizen, and you can only become a U.S. citizen if you weren't born a U.S. citizen, in most cases by passing an English test. So by definition, why should we be doing any election stuff in languages other than English when, by definition, you can't even legally vote unless you've demonstrated that you already know how to speak English? It's a fair question. It's a fair question. But I guess I have two major responses. One is one that comes out of my own experience. I grew up in a bilingual household. My mother was an immigrant, and I know how it works in the real world. My mother spoke almost accent-free, beautiful, fluent English. But when it came to technical instructions, I don't care whether it was how to run the toaster or a government document. I know, I lived this, I grew up in this house. She and everyone like her that I knew much preferred technical instructions, not conversational English, technical instructions, how to do something in her own native language. That's just the way of the world, no matter how fluent otherwise someone is in another language. And then the second thing I would just point out historically is Minnesota has been doing some version of exactly this since 1896, not 1996, 1896. When we first started printing all materials in multiple languages for those whose native language wasn't English. The only difference, as far as I can tell, between what we started doing in 1896 in Minnesota and what this bill extends now is the languages. Back then, it was Swedish and Norwegian and French and German and Italian and Slovenian. Now, none of those languages are on the list. They've been replaced by different languages based on who we are and who the non-native English speakers are. So, because this bill incentivizes good behavior and conduct and experience by and for young people, and because it recognizes the need for bilingual folks at polling places, I think it's a great idea, a novel idea. I'm proud to support it, and I respectfully ask members for support. Thank you.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. And I was going to mention that my grandparents came right around 1900 to this country, and when they became citizens, they spoke Swedish. And there are pockets, if we go back in our history in the state, there are pockets around the state that were enclaves that's what they spoke, different languages, German up around St. Cloud, Scandia, we had a high Swedish population. So this is nothing new, as you said, in the state. Members, I got questions here. The first person on my list is Representative Kosnick. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize to the committee again. My video is not working. I was wondering if the author could clarify a little bit about the judges to serve without party affiliation, the importance of that, cuts to the bill, and I think I have some that causes me some concerns in addition to another $500,000 payment cost to this bill. So, but most importantly, if you could speak to the election judges suddenly not having a partisan affiliation, because I think it's important.
Representative Claiborne.
Preserve that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kosnick, the bill refers to trainee election judges not having party affiliation. And I think it's important because we're talking about walking people through the process. We're not talking about helping them vote. They're not people to help facilitate the vote. This is how the system works. So if you would think about these trainee election judges possibly as someone who would greet you at the door in your birth language to say, this is how you do it. You go to this table, you go to that table. And I think people would feel better about that if they did not have party affiliation. But I would defer to Secretary of State Simon if he would want to address the issue.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, I would just echo what Representative Claiborne said. This, my read of the bill is that this refers to the trainee judges who overwhelmingly are young people, 16 and 17 year olds. And I don't want to speak for the author, but I think the idea here is, you know, can we please wait until we're 18 before we start labeling people red or blue? That the youngest judges, I think, deserve some political anonymity. I don't want to speak for the author, but I imagine that's what she's trying to get at.
Follow-up, Representative Kosnick.
Well, it still is, you know, elections are partisan by nature, and 18-year-old high school students need to know, you know, they may be somewhat independent, but they need to understand the partisan nature of the election systems. So I think that would cause a little bit of concern, and still the fiscal cost to it too. Certainly have nothing against having high school students participate in the process or be engaged. And I've found that oftentimes they're willing to come and learn and without a $500,000 cost to it. Thank you for the time.
Secretary Simon, I see your hands up there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kosnick, I certainly understand your concern, and I don't know if this would address your concern or not, but under statute, the trainee judges, there are certain aspects or certain jobs that they can't do, or someone who, like them, doesn't declare a partisan affiliation, there's certain of the more sensitive things they can't do. For example, you know, in Minnesota, we have curbside voting, where if someone wants to drive up in their vehicle and they want to vote from there, the law says that you have to have at least one election from each major party for all the obvious reasons, right? You don't want a Democratic judge going out to the parking lot with a ballot and somehow coaching the person in their car voting, and you wouldn't want a Republican doing that either. That's an example of those more partisan jobs, let's say, at the polling place that the trainees are not allowed to do. That's why I said earlier they can do many of or most of the functions, but there are some, the partisan stuff, the stuff where you would want to know who's a D and who's an R. Those young people, they're not allowed to do those things. So I don't know if that addresses your concern or at least helps. Thank you.
Members, if you remember, we've got another bill after this, and we want to move this along. So if we keep our questions short and our answers short, the next person on my list is Representative Quam. Did you have your hand up? I don't see your hand up.
Mr. Chair, it was touched upon, and so I'm going to let that go in and because of time.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Bonner, you're the next on my list then.
Thank you. And I actually have more, I guess, a comment than a question, but just wanted to say I want to thank Representative Claiborne for bringing this bill forward. And I really applaud the attention to bringing these high school students into the fold in terms of their civic duty. I know my family, it was very important for me to go with my parents to the polling place each and every year, and they felt that was really important to model that behavior. And of course, here I am today. I've also served as an election judge, and I just want to say this is also a tremendous idea because, you know, there are many jobs in the polling place that are really simple. You know, instructing someone how to initial a form or to fill in an oval completely to make sure that their vote counts. These are really basic, easy jobs, and it makes really good sense to be able to get high school students involved and be able to help instruct people in the simplest of things like filling in an oval so that their ballot gets counted. And so for that reason, I really want to thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's a tremendous idea. And also, you know, I do think I appreciate the idea of keeping things nonpartisan in the beginning as those young people are still forming their ideas of who they are and what their beliefs and values are. And certainly pressuring them into declaring something before they're ready, I don't think is appropriate for 16 and 17-year-olds. But certainly it gives them an opportunity to see the process in action and to be involved. And we know that when that happens, that those voters tend to be voters for life. So thank you so much, Representative Greenman.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate this bill as an investment in our making our elections and our future elections run. I'm wondering if maybe the bill author or maybe the Secretary of State could speak to how many election judges we need every year and what the average age is currently.
I believe Secretary Simon stated that we had over 30,000 judges, election judges needed. And Secretary Simon, about the age, average age.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I can't give you an exact number, but they tend to skew, you know, much older than the general population. They tend disproportionately to be retirees or seniors, and they do a great job. It's just that we need to always be replenishing the stock of those who do the job.
Representative Greenman, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I remember during this conversation about how we ensure that our pandemic elections run, that there is a real focus on how do we make sure that we are ensuring that there are young folks and middle-aged folks and sort of everybody doing their job. I think this is the way to do it and to make sure that we have both a next generation and also a next generation that looks like the voters that they're serving. So I really appreciate this bill. I think it's actually really a pretty simple but important investment in making sure that our elections run into the future. So thank you for bringing it.
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sometimes I wonder if I'm the only one reading the text of the bill, but members, line 1.12 strikes out the current law that says without party affiliation and moves it later in the same line with new language. Members, that's simply a grammatical change of some sort. I would have a question, Mr. Chair, for Secretary Simon. I'm curious how much money is spent. If we look at the appropriation for $500,000 for recruiting, members, bring your attention. It's not just for bilingual trainee election judges. It's also for bilingual election judges, which is really kind of a change in theme from the rest of the bill before it. I'm curious, Secretary Simon, how much money is your department, your agency, appropriated by the legislature each biennium, and then how much of that is used for election judge training and recruitment?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Raskowski. There is no, zero is earmarked for that purpose right now, zero. So for that specific purpose. What we do, obviously, and many of you know this, we don't in our office hire, train, or pay any election judges, but we help the counties and the cities and the townships do that. We train the trainers, we do the manuals, we do the work here at the legislature and that sort of thing. So it's pretty dispersed. There is no line item in the budget for that amount, but our election staff does actively help, and we certainly had to during COVID in this last year, help them brainstorm about opportunities, how to recruit people, how to have backups, how to perhaps train county or city or township employees to be in reserve, so to speak, if someone at the last minute for health reasons or others had to drop out, who took the training. Those are things we did, but in terms of a precise line item, that's really difficult to say.
Representative Skalski, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering, Secretary Simon, how much is your budget?
Secretary Simon.
Oh, it's about 15 million biennium.
So thank you. So thank you, Representative Scalzi. One last question, then we got to go to Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I mean, we, so there's 15 million already spent for the Secretary of State, and apparently they're prioritizing zero for recruitment of election judges. And so I find this to be an interesting thing here. But another thing, just general theme on line 2.1 and 2.2, and members, we're seeing this in bills, in a number of bills. I saw in a bill that came before the Education Committee. Why are we, this is a question, why are we writing in law telling local units of government what they can do? I mean, we give them the boundaries to operate. I just don't know why we're doing this again. If they already have the authority to determine as a school board if they're going to have the students receive credit for this, why are we providing this extra language? Members, our statutes are already about 10 feet long. They don't need to be longer. That's all I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Koznick, and I'll get to Representative Claiborne. You can wrap up after Representative Koznick. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to comment, you know, in this bill, we're claiming that 16 and 17 year olds are still growing and aren't mature enough to declare a political party. And, maybe cause them a little stress if they had to say if they're a conservative or a Democrat. But then in another bill, quite expensive bill, in addition to this bill, where we want to automatically register 15, 16, and 17 year olds when they apply for a learner's permit to drive. And so I just think it's not a very coherent argument that they're not mature enough to declare a party. And if you actually talk to some teenagers, high school kids, they have very interesting and definite political views. So I just wanted to make that aware. The other thing is, the comment was made that, you know, we want these people to look like the people that they're serving, and but that there's nothing in the bill that says they have to serve in the precinct in which they live. In fact, that they could serve in a whole county opposite of where they live. So I just don't see the consistency in the arguments here, and I'll be voting no.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Claiborne, you want to do your follow-up, and then we're going to get to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I always appreciate a robust conversation, especially when it comes to our elections. I would like to just say that I did, in fact, mention when we were introducing the bill that this is to recruit. This is the money that is allocated in this bill is for the Secretary of State to provide grants to the political subdivisions to recruit. So this money will not be used by the Secretary of State's office, but to be used by those political subdivisions all around our state to help recruit bilingual election judges and the bilingual trainees. To the statement that was made about the school boards, I would just like to say that the language is permissive, and it comes from a trainee being denied credit because the school board said they did not have the authority to do that. So it's permissive language, it's not mandatory language, but it would allow those districts who had some confusion about what the law does to allow them to grant that credit to students. Members, this is just a very good bill. It allows local communities to have the language skills that they need in their local precincts to help every citizen vote. And I ask for your yes vote. Thank you.
And Representative Claiborne, you want to renew your motion?
I do renew my motion that House File 1585 be referred to education policy. Thank you.
Representative Claiborne renews her motion to refer this bill to education policy. Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
He's excused. He had to leave.
Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Cleburne.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
No.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative New Brindley.
No.
Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski, aye.
Representative Klom.
No.
With a vote of 8 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The motion prevails. The bill's on its way to education policy. And the last bill on our agenda is Representative Stevenson's House File 1183. And Representative Stevenson, are you here? I see you on my list. Representative Stevenson, I'll move House File 1183 to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Stevenson, describe your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As everyone on this committee knows, the high cost of prescription drugs is an incredible problem. As a member of the legislature, you talk to a lot of people, you hear a lot of stories, but among the most memorable conversations, whether it happens when you're out door knocking in a fall campaign or talking with a constituent in your office, are those with people who are struggling to afford the drugs they need to live. I think all members have had those conversations, and they break your heart. No one should have to choose between paying the mortgage and paying for their children's medication. No one should have to pick between skipping a meal or skipping a pill. But people in Minnesota make those decisions every day. And we all know that the prescription drug market is complex. And while we all wish there was one silver bullet to solve the problem, this is more of a case where we need silver buckshot. The legislature, this committee included, I'm sure, has moved substantial legislation this year that if enacted would help. Representative Morrison has a great bill about a pharmaceutical accountability board, affordability board. Representative Bierman, Representative Liebling, both have great bills to increase the cost of prescription drugs. Those are all good steps forward, and this bill is another piece of the puzzle. It addresses situations where prescription drug prices are high, not because of the free market, not because of research and development costs, but because of greed. And we've all seen the stories in the news media about bad actors raising the price of life-saving drugs by shocking amounts overnight. When a pharmaceutical company does that, when they raise the price of a drug that has been on the market for years by 500%, it's not because it suddenly got 500% more expensive to make the drug. It's because someone realized that the people who take that drug need it to live and would pay anything to get it. That's price gouging. It's wrong, and there should be consequences. Members will know that I'm a prosecutor when the legislature is not in session, and I believe in accountability, and that's what this bill is about. We're not saying that all pharmaceutical companies are bad actors, far from it. You don't need to look far these days to see the good work that pharmaceutical companies are doing. They can work miracles. But this is a case where the Spider-Man rule comes into play. With great power comes great responsibility, and a handful of bad actors are abusing their power. One last note, this isn't the first time the legislature has considered similar legislation. Indeed, a very similar bill passed the House last biennium. This bill, however, is different in a material way. It applies to generic or off-patent drugs only, where last year's bill applied to all drugs. And that change is due to a recent federal court decision. I think that decision is unfortunate, and I'm hoping it's reviewed and reversed. But I think this narrower approach is best given the current legal landscape. As I said before, this isn't a silver bullet. It's just one piece of the puzzle. And Mr. Chair, I believe there are some testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Chair Stevenson, I have on my list here, Brett Michelin. Please identify yourself for the record and I receive your testimony.
Morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brett Michelin. I'm with the Association for Accessible Medicines. AAM represents the generic and biosimilar manufacturers, and we are opposed to this bill. Unfortunately, the focus being on just generic and off-patent drugs is not focusing on what is driving the high cost of medications for patients in Minnesota. In fact, generic drugs are only 2% of the total healthcare spend, as I think is noted in your fiscal analysis based on the California reporting. In fact, less than 1% of healthcare premiums is based on the cost of generic drugs. That's not what is driving high healthcare costs. Some of the drugs that have been focused on, you can always cherry pick if there's been a large increase in a price of a drug. However, one example that's been used on this bill is Prozac. There are 38 manufacturers of Prozac. If one increases its price, it might simply be because their line is down, they've lost access to the active pharmaceutical ingredient. But when you have a price range from $1.61 to almost $800, that's not necessarily going to affect the market. In fact, it likely won't affect the market because there's three wholesalers that buy 90% of all prescription drugs, and they make the decision on where to send the drug. If it goes into Minnesota, then it's the insurers and the PBMs who determine how much a patient is going to pay, not the generic manufacturer. This bill is focusing on the wrong aspect. This will have unintended state costs as well. It's going to require manufacturers to maintain an office and a registered agent in the state. That will increase the cost of generic drugs. Further, this bill has been found unconstitutional in the only other state that has passed it. I know there's sensitivity to for legislators hearing that there's likely another lawsuit, but since it's been found unconstitutional once, it's entirely possible to be found unconstitutional another time, and it was not based on the court case raised by Representative Stevenson. It was based on a court case on this specific law passed in Maryland. And with that, I'll conclude. I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michelin. I see I've got Ms. Moline from the Attorney General's office are here to just answer questions, or do you need to give testimony?
Mr. Chair, I'm just here to answer questions today and happy to do so.
Thank you. Questions on my list. The first person I have is Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And frankly, if we wanted to decrease the cost of medications, we would look at individualized medicine, pharmacogenomics, so that you aren't spending money on drugs that aren't going to work for you. We help with the disparities, et cetera. But on this bill, it almost seems like virtue signaling because of the flaws. I don't see that this can actually make it through. The testifier's stated reasoning, but the main reason I have is Minnesota's not an island. This is the kind of bill that, if done right, would be done at the federal level. If we want to increase lawsuits, have the Attorney General do court actions and that, just that perception makes it less likely that people want to sell to Minnesota when they can sell to the other states all around us. If we are unilaterally increasing the cost of generic drugs, then I think the harm will be in supply and won't be in cost to us. So I would hope the author would look at the flaws, try to fix the bill, but I really hope that the federal government would address it so that Minnesota doesn't have the double-edged sword effect when we try to do something thinking we're an island. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I didn't hear a question there. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm hoping you'll allow me to ask one question of both Ms. Moline from the Attorney General's office and one to the bill author. My question to Ms. Moline is, you know, the Attorney General sent a letter to the House Commerce Committee, and in it he said, without the bill, prices of existing generic drugs will continue to rise at a rate that far outpaces inflation. And I'm wondering if you know what the rate of increase of generic drug prices has been over the past few years.
Ms. Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. It varies based on which drug, but there is plenty of information out there on price spikes specific to generic drugs that would be covered under this legislation. So I'm happy to get you more details on the rates of those specifics, but again, it varies.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I mean, I can, just so committee members are aware, the AARP Public Policy Institute, they put out a prescription price watch study, And they found that the average annual retail prices for almost 400 commonly used generics actually fell in price by 9.3% in 2017. And they've been in deflation of just under 12% for almost 2 years. So I think that that's important when we're looking at this bill. My question to the bill author, Mr. Chair, is who determines how much I pay at the pharmacy for my generic drug? Is it the manufacturer or the PBM or the health insurer? Who determines what I, as the consumer, pays at the pharmacy?
Representative Stevenson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Brindley, as I mentioned in my remarks, pharmaceutical pricing is incredibly complex. I wish there was a simple answer to that question. If there was a simple answer to that question, the problem of trying to tackle prescription drug pricing would be easy to solve because you'd go to that person and you'd regulate it there. But, you know, there are a multitude of factors that play in, and the bill recognizes that. I think it, you know, and to kind of go to your question to Ms. Moline, I think it's wrong to try and look at it from a totality basis. Remember what I said in my remarks. What we're trying to do here is bring accountability for specific bad actors, right, who are increasing the price gouging. This isn't made, I'm making no representation to this committee that this is the end all and be all of all prescription drug affordability issues. But to suggest that there isn't price gouging going on in the generic market ever, that it never happens, I think is quite a claim. I don't think that that's true at all. I think that there are examples, and we can look at specific examples if you like, of prices that were increased by pharmaceutical companies specifically for only for profit motive into the extreme. So, you know, keep it in the perspective that it's intended, that this is one tool in the toolbox, not the solution to the whole problem.
And I see Ms. Moline has her hand up from the AG's office. Ms. Moline, quickly.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I had just found some additional information that I thought Representative New would find helpful on generics specifically. Daraprim in 2015 raised the price of the off-patented version, which is a common drug used to protect HIV and AIDS patients, from $13.50 to $750 per pill overnight, a 5,000% increase. A liquid version of generic Prozac jumped from $9 to $69, an increase of 667%. A generic
Ms. Moline, can you email that to all of the members? We have more questions here and we're running out of time, and I don't want to run out of time on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate those responses, and I also appreciate, you know, I'm a little concerned, and I appreciate Mr. Michelin's testimony about why those prices may have gone up, and I think it's a dangerous and bold statement to say that it's only for profit motive and in the extreme, Representative Stevenson. I think that's an irresponsible statement. I just want to point out, you know, I understand the issues of the federal law, but you know, when a generic drug goes from $100 to $130, but my copay stays the same at $10 or whatever it may be, I'm not sure what this bill does to save the consumer from the high price of prescription drugs. And on the flip side of this, you know, when we've got When I've got a drug, again, let's use the same example, that if I'm taking a prescription drug that can go from $100 to $130, and now the Attorney General's office is going to spend time and resources going after that manufacturer. However, we can have a brand drug that can go from $10,000 to $20,000 a month, and we do nothing about it. Like, this is the kind of thing that's lipstick on a pig.
Brindley, can you wrap up quickly here? We've got two more people.
We're not actually solving the problem. And Mr. Chair, can you clarify, where did you say this bill is going?
It's going to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. Is it making a stop in judiciary? This has a private right of action and a new a penalty of $500,000 for withdrawing. This clearly needs to go to the Judiciary Committee.
We're sending it to Ways and Means. If they need to, they can get it from Ways and Means. Representative Kosnick, you're the next person on my list. And members, at 9:57, it's 9:55 right now. At 9:57, we are going to vote on this bill.
We still haven't figured out time management in this committee, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Stevenson, you know, I applaud your efforts or intent to provide lower cost medicine and lower cost health care. But I question that this bill actually does that. You know, basically what we're doing is price setting. And I guess that's one way to cap the cost of something. But I think it needs to be balanced with providing some of the best health care that we can receive. If you take a look at the current pandemic, we have through ingenuity and the free market, well, the government, we encourage people to go out and find a cure and a vaccine for the current pandemic. I'm wondering if the testifier, Mr. Michelin, could discuss what having a financial penalty hanging over the market of $500,000 on any manufacturer, what that would do to provide incentive to provide good health care in Minnesota.
Mr. Michelin, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the potential fines, what that does is when there's multiple manufacturers for the exact same drug, it leads to the potential of some manufacturers pulling out of that particular line of drug, which decreases competition. And it's competition in the generic market that drives the price down. Prozac, again, 38 manufacturers. Just because the price goes up by one manufacturer is not going to affect the cost structure for the patients, for the insurers, for the PBMs, who are pharmacies who are profiting off these drugs as well. Hope that answered the question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, it's 9:57 and we need to vote on this bill. No, sorry,
Mr.
for the
Chair,
people.
I guess I would just end with, you know, the author himself had said that this is not the end all or be all to address this issue. I think the ideas need to be more well vetted, as Representative New Brindley had mentioned. There's concerns with
Representative Kosnick.
And I'm concerned about additional lawsuits that were mentioned. And I think this bill needs more work.
Representative Kosnick, thank you for that. With members with that, Representative Stevenson, I'll renew my motion that House File 1183 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
Nope.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative New Brindley.
No.
Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski, aye.
Representative Quam.
No.
With a vote of 8 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. You're on your way. Members, I just got a note here.
Oh, sorry, please go ahead.
Representative, I got a note here that we've got just notified from HHS or from Education Policy that they do not need to see Representative Claiborne's bill. So members, I'm going to move to take reconsider the vote on House File 1585. Members, and that will be a voice vote. So all in favor of reconsidering 1585, please say aye.
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 Aye. Members, I'll change my motion on House File 1585 that 1585 be referred to the General Register. Members, Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
No.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative New Brindley. Representative New Brindley. Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski, aye.
Representative Klom.
No.
Chair, I'm seeing a note from fiscal staff.
Yes. What's the note from fiscal staff?
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Claiborne's bill, because there is an appropriation in the bill, I would say you have two options: to either lay it over for inclusion in the omnibus, or you could send it to Ways and Means, and we'd have to reconcile that spending there.
Mr. Chair, may I ask then that we hold it over for possible inclusion?
Members, we'll hold this over then for possible inclusion. Thank you. Members, with that, it's 10:01. We are adjourned.